please visit hfcc.edu/learnlab.
Of Henry Ford College, you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists. Today's WHFR Journal is from our friends at PRX. Enjoy.
This is Climate One. Summer is here, temperatures are rising, and so are electric bills. That means many Americans are facing a severely overlooked issue: power shutoffs.
It means that you cannot turn on your lights, you do not have refrigeration, you cannot access the internet, you cannot cool your house.
Regulations protecting customers haven't kept up with the reality of the climate crisis.
We are experiencing more extreme weather, and I think our policies and our protections that are in place are woefully inadequate.
But there are ways to help customers and utilities save energy and thus money.
So it's a win-win-win for the consumer. You're not paying anything out of pocket when the program is designed well. It is not tied to your personal income or your credit score. It stays on the bill.
The danger of home power shutoffs. Up next on Climate One.
Thematic, thematic. Heard on Wednesdays from 12 to 4. Thematic, thematic. Music and themes and so much more. Sometimes things can get dramatic, and sometimes things can get rather silly. But one thing's for sure, Phil Mack will guide you through and try to leave you feeling giddy, and try to leave you feeling happy. Thematic, thematic. Heard on Wednesdays from 12 to 4. Thematic, thematic.
Pick a Phil.
Interviews, the classics.
And so much more. Thematic, thematic, thematic.
Woo! Catch Thematic with Phil Mack every Wednesday from 12 to 4.
To protect her home and family in a disaster, Karen was willing to wade through water, mud, and insurance paperwork.
Yeah, I can do this.
You go, Karen! By simply understanding and updating what her insurance covers and doesn't cover now, she'll be better prepared no matter when disaster strikes. Learn other simple ways to protect your home and family before a natural disaster at ready.gov. That's ready.gov. A message from FEMA and the Ad Council.
I'm Mariana Brocious.
I'm Kusha Navadar.
And this is Climate One.
We're paying exorbitant amounts in rates and fees for a power grid that is not truly servicing us. We have many outages, and those outages have a huge economic impact, and not just on families, but also on small businesses.
Right now, me personally, I had an 81% increase in my auto insurance, a 45% increase in my home insurance, an increase in the water, gas, electric, phone, food, gasoline, everything. I mean, I'm like every other resident in Michigan. We're just struggling.
I personally grew up in poverty, and my parents struggled to keep the lights on. There were days when I would come home from school and there would be no electricity at home because my parents, despite working long hours, couldn't afford the electricity bill. And things have only gotten worse. Now, as an adult, I'm constantly in fear of not being able to afford my bills, including my electric bills, to the point that I've considered getting a second job just to afford it all.
Those were the voices of Roshan Harris, Aaron Liberty, and Monica Booker speaking at a public hearing in Detroit last April. Kusha, what's your reaction when you hear their testimony?
Yeah, I feel two things. The first is this is obviously urgent in so many individual homes and individual people's lives. And then that one voice of the individual that said, I live in constant fear, so much so that I almost took a second job. I think that really brings it into perspective for me for how difficult rate hikes and potential shutoffs are in a person's life. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, all of us have seen higher bills, you know, these inflationary pressures, all kinds of monthly expenses, as we heard one person there cite, are going up, you know, groceries just as the tip of the iceberg, and it's putting a lot of pressure on everybody's finances. And I think this is the context that we're in as we're hearing about electricity rates going even higher across much of the country.
Yeah, when people can't pay their utility bills, the power companies generally have the right to cut them off. Along with prices, this practice, though, is also on the rise. In 2024, over 600,000 American households had their power shut off due to an inability to pay.
Yeah, and that is a shockingly high number. And it's more than just an inconvenience. This is really dangerous. In hot summer months like the ones we're in now, people rely on air conditioning that literally can keep them alive.
Exactly. More people die from extreme heat than from hurricanes, floods, and tornadoes combined, often in their own homes when they can't afford the AC. I mean, it's a horrible situation. And most states have shut off protections during winter months, but only 23 states, so that's less than half of the states in the United States, have laws that prevent utilities from shutting off power during extreme heat events.
And extreme heat is becoming a growing trend. We've seen it several of the last summers. Places that didn't used to have really high temperatures are suddenly seeing them. And so this is a problem that really needs to be addressed now. Fortunately, there are people working hard on solutions that work for both the utilities and the ratepayers, customers like you and me. We'll hear about several of these a bit later in the show. But first, Kusha, you spoke with Jean Sue. She's the Energy Justice Director and Senior Attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, and she laid out some of the reasons behind these rising electricity rates, along with the rising rates of shutoffs.
Yeah, the Center for Biological Diversity has been tracking electricity shutoffs along with the profits of six major utilities across the U.S. I asked Sue what the top line takeaway was from that research.
Right now, the United States is facing an epidemic of shutoffs with over 665,000 households who were shut off in 2024. And at the same time, we have utilities, private utilities, making bank over that same year. So in comparison to the year before, we have around 20% more households who are being cut off because they cannot afford electricity. And interestingly enough, we have the same increase of 21% in profits of those same utilities over that period.
Wow. So the companies that are delivering electricity are making record profits. The people, individuals who can't necessarily afford to pay are experiencing more shutoffs than ever. Is that a fair summarization?
That is a total great summary of what is happening. And I think when you look at the scale of profits, it is absolutely incredible to see how accelerated the profits have been since 2018 until now. They just keep going higher. And then in 2024, it peaked. We only have data up to 2024, but right. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
Shutoffs are such a devastating event. It means that you cannot turn on your lights. You do not have refrigeration. You cannot access the internet if you're using, you know, internet at home. All of those things are because you cannot afford it. And what we found is that these profiting utilities, if they had just taken 1.4% of their shareholder dividends, they could have totally wiped out the debt of all of those 665,000 households, which is such a drop in the bucket for them to actually save lives and keep people online for power.
That statistic jumped out at me when I was reading through the report, and I want to unpack that in a second. Before we do that, let's look at the factors that make this situation extra egregious. So it seems like the number of shutoffs have increased significantly in recent years. Why is that?
A number of reasons. One reason is because utilities have been hiking up rates for people. If you are part of a private utility, you probably will have experienced an increase in your rates. It's because they are building out more fossil fuel power plants. They are also passing on fossil fuel volatility from around the world. So because of the Ukraine war, we actually saw a huge spike in gas prices around the world. And utilities are just passing that buck off to customers and not taking any responsibility for it.
And it sounds like climate change is also another big issue here. Is that right?
Absolutely. So climate change is a huge second factor. Right now, when you pay for your electricity, you're paying for something. And what's happened in the last few years is that we have had extreme heat sweep this country. So people are turning on their air conditioning at rates they've never turned them on before, trying to cool their house to stay alive in some places around the country. So that piques people's demand of electricity, which is also why their bill is much higher.
Okay, so that's on, I guess, the demand side. There was also one that stuck out to me that you've also already mentioned. Utility companies are making buck, right? They're going to bank. That's what you said. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So they're jacking up your rates. And one reason they're able to do that is they are applying for higher rates based on building out new infrastructure. So utilities make money by building out more infrastructure. And they have been saying we need more fossil fuel plants online, more methane gas online. So they are building those out and actually charging you as the ratepayer for that build out. One of the big threats that's coming up under this administration is the build out of data centers and artificial intelligence, which suck up tons and tons of energy. Guess who is paying for the power for those data centers and AI? That's you and me. Yeah, it's you. It's you in particular, Kusha. It's all falling on you.
Great.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I got enough student loans, whatever.
Yeah,
tack it on.
Absolutely. So we have very rich tech companies building out data centers. They need to power them. They're not soaking up the costs. They're actually working with the utilities, and the utilities are forecasting also these data centers and saying, hey, we need to get these data centers here. We need to build out more gas, and we need a way to pay for that. So we're just going to pass it on to consumers.
Is there any other factor that you think is worth mentioning that is leading to more shutoffs than ever before for individuals?
I think the main issue for the last election and last few years has been kitchen table economics, and people are suffering from inflation. So the inflationary context of the last few years have made it such that people are struggling to pay every single bill, whether it's your grocery bill with your eggs or your electricity bill. So that macroeconomic factor of inflation is also a big part of this story. One fine point I want to put on this all, though, when we really unpack who is the most vulnerable to shutoffs, we are looking at the poorest of the poor in this country and communities of color. And one really startling factor that many people don't realize is that areas where communities of color live in this country tend to be hotter than areas where white people live. So, for example, a study was done in Oregon, in Portland, where they found that one area of the city where white people lived was 10 degrees cooler than the area where Black neighborhoods were. And the reason for that was tree cover, that white neighborhoods had tree cover. They had that urban planning, so they had that type of shade to be given. But Black neighborhoods didn't have those types of resources. The public did not invest in tree cover or parks or nature in those areas. And on top of that, public housing is incredibly decrepit with very bad insulation. So even if you are cooling, it escapes the house because the envelope is so porous. And so these factors for shutoffs are especially, especially dire for communities of color and other poor communities across the country.
Why don't these utilities just cover the cost of non-payment?
I think that's a fantastic question, Kusha. That is the heart of our crisis right now of electricity in this country. We have a system that is a public good. Electricity is a human right for many, many people. Without it, you cannot survive. Your food will go bad. You cannot get internet. You cannot cool your house. You cannot heat your house in some areas. This is a basic human right. And yet, private companies that have shareholders control the ability to turn off or turn on your electricity. And for some people, that is a life and death decision. There was a woman in Arizona in 2018. She was a 72-year-old woman. She was unable to afford her rising electricity bill because Phoenix is hit the worst, you know, during the summer for heat, from climate change. And she was unable to pay her bill. Her outstanding debt was $51, and the local utility cut her power off. Wow. And that woman ended up passing away. So when we say electricity is a basic human right and it's a life and death matter, it really is a life and death matter. And so it's abominable to me that private utilities have the ability to control that. And this all circles back to they are driven by private profit. They guarantee their shareholders a certain amount of profit every single year and just a de minimis, a tiny, tiny amount, a drop in the bucket for them, pennies, can be dedicated to wiping out debt and actually saving lives. But our capitalist system, these private corporations, that is not part of their calculus. And we have no regulations right now to make that part of the system.
It is difficult to hear that life and death over $51. Like, that is definitely difficult to hear. Are there not laws in place to stop them from slipping through the cracks? Is there policy that exists in different states, in Arizona, for instance, to stop the most vulnerable from experiencing this kind of tragic situation?
So there are laws in place to help with extreme temperatures. And so I'll unpack that briefly. One is that across the country, most states actually have a winter moratorium. And so that means that when it gets too cold, this is particularly relevant for gas companies, because Right. Most people still heat through gas versus electricity. But there are gas moratoria where if it hits, you know, below zero in 44 states around the country, a moratorium kicks in and gas companies aren't allowed to cut off gas. So that's good. The opposite, though, is not true on the extreme heat side. Less than half of the states, 22 states, do have some type of summer moratorium on shutoffs. So oftentimes it is either a temperature-based one where at 100 degrees it kicks in, or it's time-based. So, you know, starting in June, for example, which happened in Arizona. And so, you know, first of all, not all the states have that. And given the huge heat dome that ripped across the country last year, on average killing 154 people per day, that is no longer acceptable not to have a moratorium. But even for the temperature-based or date-based things that exist, they aren't good enough right now.
Where laws do exist to prevent shutoffs, are they successful? Is there anything that you can point to on the other side of the results spectrum, I guess you would call it?
So on temperature-based stuff, those can all be improved. But I think on the other side of your question is like deeper questions about what can change. And there are several things along the spectrum here. Probably the most progressive thing to do, or the most transformational part, is to reimagine our entire system of how electricity should be developed and create utilities that are public and that are accountable. And so I put those two together because we have many public utilities in this country that still do the same things, if not worse, than private corporation utilities. And that's because they are not accountable at all.
Is there other low-hanging fruit for addressing this?
There's mid-hanging fruit. Yeah. Mid-hanging fruit here. Yeah. Okay. So next rung on the ladder.
Yeah.
There's something called performance rate basing, which means that right now utilities get to raise your rates by saying that they're going to build a new fossil gas plant. And they say, yeah, we're going to build this new fossil gas plant. Therefore, we need to charge you as the customer this amount. And that's just going to increase your rates by another 10%. So the utility commissions allow them to do that. This is the way that rates have always been made. It's based on capital intensity, and it's based on that investment that the utility makes. And utilities have the right to recover that money from people, from everyday customers. One way to actually change that and flip the scale is to have performance-based rates, which allow us to say, hey, we don't want to get charged based on fossil fuel infrastructure or new energy infrastructure. We actually want to be charged or have utilities be held accountable by their performance. How many blackouts were there? Were there zero blackouts? Were poor people able to come back online and they weren't cut off? What are our ideal performance metrics here? And then be able to rate base off of that. So that's something that Hawaii has actually been dealing with. And right now it's looking like it's better than nothing. So flipping the whole formula of how utilities can recover rates is a huge question. But something that's probably a bit more digestible for people are alternative systems of being able to put up rooftop solar and storage on their homes. And this is something that we find is really, really important in this new era of the climate emergency. So rooftop solar and storage are a cheap way to actually get energy on your rooftop and have that storage and be able to actually survive the climate disasters around us. We have worked in Puerto Rico, we've worked in North Carolina, areas that have huge hurricanes, where the only families left with power at the end of these horrific, horrific events are those with rooftop solar and storage. And that has been a huge boon for people to have reliable and affordable energy. Unfortunately, what's been happening is that utilities all across the country have been trying to get rid of your ability to put up rooftop solar. And this comes in the form of rolling back net energy metering programs to putting a fixed fee, and that disincentivizes people to put up rooftop solar and storage.
If you're in the elevator with somebody who was paying their electricity bill every month and actually could afford to pay and wasn't running into these issues, what would you say to them?
I would say get involved in your utility commission proceedings and take a stand. We need to actually democratize energy so that it's affordable for people. Work with your legislatures, go to the commission and hold these utilities accountable. One way to do it is everyday people can actually get involved in these public proceedings and just say, no, we refuse this rate hike. Yes, we want a shutoff ban to protect the poorest of the poor. And no, we don't want our utility to have runaway profits, which they have been doing year after year after year. They are jacking up their rates. People are getting very upset all across the economic spectrum, and they feel powerless about what to do because everybody is beholden to these utilities. We can actually go in front of our commissions. We can lobby our state legislatures and say, we need to hold our utilities accountable. And they are not allowed to raise these rates. And they also need to give us cheap, affordable, and reliable clean energy.
Jean Hsu is Energy Justice Director and Senior Attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity. Jean, thank you so much for all of your work and for sitting with us and unpackaging this really important topic. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Kusha.
Coming up, the climate crisis is making many of us more vulnerable to dangerous temperatures, but in many places, protections haven't kept up.
More states have cold weather protections than do states that have hot weather protections, and this is likely plaguing those places that are particularly hot.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
I think you need a reset. Time to reflect on the week you've had and prepare for the rest of the week to come. A few hours to tune out and focus on calming the soul. If that sounds like your jam, tune in to Midweek Midnights every Wednesday from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. right here on WHFR Radio. Join me, your host, Radio K, in showcasing both new and old shoegaze, indie alternative, and dreamy ambient space music that takes over the airwaves, ready to drift you into your happy place. So tune in this Wednesday and hop on the Midweek Midnight Spaceship. You won't want to miss your ride.
Get in, loser. We're going shopping.
Take charge of your college experience. The HFC Student Activities Office can help you connect with or start a club, plan and promote events or fundraisers, or even find volunteer opportunities in our community. The HFC Student Activities Office operates 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Thursday in the fall and winter semesters, and 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Thursday in the summer semester. You can find the HFC Student Activities Office on campus in the M Building, or call 313-845-9865. That's 313-845-9865.
This is Climate One. I'm Ariana Brocious. According to the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, one in seven households is behind on their energy bills. And when a utility decides to disconnect a household's power supply, it can create a vicious cycle that's difficult for people to get out of. I spoke with Sonia Carley, who co-directs the Energy Justice Lab at the University of Pennsylvania, about how to address the rising number of shutoffs. She explained what happens to a household when a shutoff occurs.
When somebody's disconnected, they may lose everything in their refrigerator, for example. They may face disconnection fees. They may lose their entire account. They may face reconnection fees, legal fees, just a variety of other expenses. It takes them a while to get back on their feet, and then they're already at a disadvantage for paying their next month's bill. These households then are also considered more risky and at more prone to being disconnected in the future, and thereby might be disconnected from their utility provider in the future if they can't recover and pay for their debt.
Considered risky by the utility.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So to avoid shutoffs, people do a number of things, and these can also be somewhat harmful in different ways. Can you explain what some of those are?
I will. And this is something that we've focused quite a bit of effort on at the Energy Justice Lab, are these financial and behavioral coping strategies. And the riskiest strategies are also the most common. So, for example, carrying debt, which is highly risky, is the leading coping strategy with 28% of all low-income households. And the second most common strategy is what we term risky temperature behavior. Now, this is behavior such as burning trash in your home or using your oven for space heat or using a dryer to warm one's body by sitting behind the dryer as it's running. But there are a variety of other strategies as well, such as keeping your home at incredibly uncomfortable temperatures, either too cold or too hot, or facing the decision of whether to put money towards food or to eat, or other strategies that I think are less risky, but as noted, very much less common, such as calling the utility for help and asking the utility if they have a payment plan, or asking a friend or a neighbor or a family member for help paying a bill.
Well, and a challenge to this can be a shameful occurrence for someone, and they may be thus less inclined to reach out for help either to a friend or family or even to the utility, right?
That's absolutely the case. And in fact, we've done quite a few interviews with individuals who have been disconnected. And one of the recurring themes that we hear is a theme of shame. Individuals who are disconnected feel incredibly bad about it. And the biggest source or foundation of shame that we've heard about is with their children who reside in the home, that they couldn't provide for their children, that they couldn't keep their children warm and safe and secure.
And I just want to say here that we're talking about electric rates increasing rapidly. We're talking about an economy that for many people is already very expensive in lots of ways. You know, these are situations that are beyond an individual's control, and it isn't somebody's fault necessarily that they can't afford a very high electric bill. But if your power is turned off because of non-payment, it could actually be a while before it gets turned back on. So can you explain what this can look like for people after their power is turned off?
I think first it's understanding the circumstances, what happened, and then seeking help. Sometimes they may not have a phone charge and they have to go and charge their phone somewhere, which means possibly walking to a neighbor's house or using somebody else's phone. It oftentimes, from what we've heard, means that an individual then desperately needs to get in touch with the utility company. Yet another theme that we've heard many times when speaking with individuals who have been disconnected is that they really struggle to actually get a person on the line at the utility company. We've heard the term robot several times, where they feel like they're talking to a robot because it is, in fact, just the system. And they end up in this perpetual cycle within the telephone system of not being able to reach somebody that can actually identify their account and take care of their circumstances and tell them what they need to do.
That's maddening, and we all experience that in different aspects of our lives, and it's just the most frustrating thing.
We sure do. And when you've just been disconnected and you're worried about what's going to happen with the food in your refrigerator and your children that night and where they're going to sleep, it's absolutely even more maddening.
Yeah. So if someone loses their power and they're not able to connect with, or even if they can connect with the utility, what are the steps it takes to get your power restored?
Well, usually it means paying that bill off, paying the amount that is owed to the utility company. And sometimes it's just the amount. Sometimes there's extra fees included. It might be a disconnection fee or a reconnection fee. So paying those fees then presumably will lead to the lights coming back on. This is usually the case from the interviews that we've conducted, though we have heard some stories of having assistance paying off the bill, but then not knowing that the individual needed to also call the utility company themselves and confirm their final details in order for their new account to be established and to be turned on, which introduced multiple days of delay before getting the power on. But this is just one specific story.
Just again, to emphasize this point, this is a really dangerous situation, especially when we're talking, as we are this episode, about extreme heat. It can be very harmful to an individual's health. This risk of electricity shutoff is a problem that faces about a quarter of American households, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. There are federal funding programs that provide low-income bill assistance, like LIHEAP, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program. Prior to the Trump administration coming into office, how important was that program in helping with these situations?
LIHEAP as a federal bill assistance program is absolutely crucial in the face of energy insecurity and utility disconnections. This is a lifeline for millions of households across the country that need that kind of emergency relief in some month when their bills just, they simply can't cover their bills. But we know that LIHEAP actually at previous funding levels, which are usually about $4 billion to $6 billion in some of the best years, were already woefully inadequate. At best, estimates are about 20% of the eligible at-need population for this bill assistance program actually had access to it.
Just a fifth of people who really need it.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I'll also note that there's seasonality here, too. If we're thinking about extreme heat, the majority of the funds for LIHEAP are used in the cold weather months because that's when it's first allocated. And the best estimate that I've heard is about 70% is already used before the summertime. So there's just a small kind of paucity of funds. In some places, it's entirely exhausted before the summer months, before the extreme heat.
And to make the situation worse in our current moment, the Trump administration has eliminated the Health and Human Services staff that administers this program.
That's right.
And his proposed budget also eliminated the program funding. So what impact do we expect that's going to have?
I think it's just a profound impact, to be honest. This is at the same time, as we noted, that energy prices are rising all across the country. And there are very few other protections and supports available for these households. I think idealists might say, well, states and nonprofits and local governments will step in and fill this gulf. They'll provide this bill assistance that the federal government did before. But these are all different entities that are struggling in their own ways right now and don't have excess funds that they can put towards this bill assistance.
Right. So I do want to turn to what solutions we have, because I think this paints kind of a dark picture, and that's real, but there are ways to minimize this harm. So let's talk about what state legislatures could do.
State legislatures can do a lot. One suite of interventions, if you will, is to tell the utility that they need to offer different kind of rate program plans. So this could be a program plan based on your percentage of income, for example, where you peg you make a decision about what the energy burden is that anybody should pay, and then you peg it to their income, and that's what one then pays on their bill. Another possibility is an arrearage management plan where one can have the opportunity over time to essentially pay off their debt. And then there's a variety of other kinds of payment plans, prepayment plans, and others that are options for utilities to offer and for states to mandate are included. State governments can also mandate disconnection protections, like they might say, from November to February, for example, nobody can be disconnected. Or they might say, if the temperature is below 32 degrees or above 90 degrees, nobody can be disconnected. Or they can offer very specific protections for vulnerable populations, such as households with young children or households that are medically compromised.
There's also measures that can come from the utility or perhaps nonprofits, maybe local governments, to do things to incentivize energy savings. Essentially, I'm thinking of weatherization, better sealing a home so you have a more efficient use of your electricity, and that's a lower use, right?
You're spot on. Actually, I'm a big fan. I call them preventative solutions. One of the leading indicators of whether a house will be energy insecure and disconnected is if their house is inefficient or deficient. So the idea is, let's do weatherization first. Let's seal up every home. Let's make it as efficient as possible so it reduces people's energy bills. And essentially, the cooler, the hot air isn't just escaping from their house. I think that that's a first, a go-to, but I think there's other preventative options as well to help households avoid that cycle of energy insecurity. One that we've studied at the Energy Justice Lab is residential solar. So we have a study that came out recently where we found that of all low-income households across the United States, actually have a random sample of them, so representative of low-income households across the states, those that have residential solar are significantly less energy insecure than households that look just like them on every other attribute that we could measure, but for the fact that they don't have solar. So solar can reduce one's energy bill and thereby help them avoid energy insecurity.
So we've outlined a lot of the challenges of this situation of electricity shutoffs and some of the solutions. And I'm curious, as you've done work with the utility disconnection dashboard, are there bright spots you're seeing? Are there signs of, you know, remedies going into effect that are helping?
Yeah, a few bright spots, actually. One is that I think more attention is being focused on this issue, and it's not just from consumer advocates, for example, and it's not just from academics. It's from all different stakeholders within the space. And it's frequent that we have conversations with utility companies, for example, and with state legislatures, for example, about what we need to do to really address this challenge. Second, the biggest source of inspiration that I've seen is that a lot of states are starting to consider whether they need to modify their disconnection protections. Again, specifically as it comes to heat, as well as data transparency and data gathering.
Sonia Carley is a Presidential Distinguished Professor of Energy Policy and City Planning at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us on Climate One.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, when utilities help cover the upfront costs for efficiency upgrades, it can be a win-win for everyone.
What we found is that when these programs are offered to consumers, you know, 90% or more people are just lining up to say, yes, this benefits me, I want it.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Does your radio sure sound good to you? I am Missy J. I am the host of The House That Jack Swing Built, Thursdays 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. on WHFR.FM, the station that's always making waves, 89.3 on your dial.
Henry Ford College's Mirror News is looking for new writers. The newspaper is student-run and a great opportunity for budding journalists to gain experience. The Mirror News covers a variety of topics such as politics, new restaurants, art exhibits, local events, and recent films. If you would like to share your talents, email Dr. Kim at pkim@hfcc.edu or the editor at editor@hfcc.edu. See yourself in the Mirror News.
This is Climate One. I'm Kusha Navidar. We've heard a lot today about how serious it can be to have your power shut off. Now, I want to discuss what we can do about it. So I invited Tamara Jones, she's the co-executive director of Clean Energy Works, to talk through some possible solutions. In 2011, Jones was named a White House Champion of Change for her work with the Southeast Energy Efficiency Alliance, administering energy retrofits across the region. She says her whole career has been about working for justice.
I was born and raised in the Caribbean, in Jamaica. My mother brought my sister and I to the States, to New York City, when I was 14. And I remember those first winters, we bought plastic sheeting and you duct taped them around the windows, which also had holes in the wall to try to, you know, limit the wind blowing in during a New York winter. And it would be like being on a ship, the sound of the plastic billowing and flapping, you know, when there was wind. So I remember trying to stay warm under blankets and electric space heaters. And my mom never complained, but I saw the bills. And so I knew what it meant for a single mother of two in Brooklyn, New York, to be keeping the heat on at that time in the mid-1980s. So, you know, my entire professional life has been in service to communities and the public sector. And a large part of that has been doing various kinds of environmental justice work, from food justice, land justice, energy justice. And so, you know, this is really answering a call and deeply personal for me.
Yeah, that image that you paint of the wind billowing and it making you feel like you're on a ship is so visceral. And I think a lot of people can relate because, you know, like right now, millions of people all across the country are at risk of getting their power cut off because they can't afford it. And in that climate, so to speak, energy retrofits can really reduce their bills and therefore reduce the risk of non-payment, right? Like it's a compelling positive cycle, I would say. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And, you know, we really need to understand that in the 21st century, now more than ever, having access to uninterrupted, affordable energy really is a human right. It's impossible to imagine what it looks like to survive and thrive in modern day America without having access to heating and cooling or electrical power.
Yeah, Tamar, it's interesting that you bring up human right, that term, because, you know, earlier in this episode, I spoke with Jean Sue, and she echoed that. And she also added that most vulnerable folks to power shutoffs are the poorest of the poor, which people often equate, I think, to communities of color. But I want to know, what do you think of that characterization of who is impacted in this context?
You know, it's part of the unfortunate history of this country, our failure to really deal with our racial history, right? We don't see all of the ways in which it gets embedded in what we think we know and how we know it. So how we use data, how we interpret data to define and tell us what is normative, you know, goes unexamined. So if one were to look, you know, at per capita, then yes, often communities of color rise to the top of lists when you're looking at the proportional impact in a community. If you look at just the raw numbers of people who suffer from utility disconnections or not having access, who are economically impoverished, working class and poor white folks vastly outnumber communities of color. So the fact that we continue to equate poverty with melanin is itself a reflection of, you know, that racial ideology. And it does a disservice to white communities who have so much in common with communities of color on these issues and prevents them from seeing that we have a shared goal sometimes and that we really need to be working more deeply aligned and in collaboration with each other.
Something like half of Americans don't have more than $1,000 of savings or even $1,000
right.
of savings.
50 million households are low income in this country, and there are not 50 million Black folks in this country. Right. So we got to like think about who is elevated to represent certain populations and who is rendered invisible. And so this feeds into one of the challenges we face, right? We talk about energy burdens in this country, which is the percentage of your income, your household income, that goes to paying for your energy bills. And the average is for non-low income households, around 3% of your income goes to pay for your energy bill.
Well,
for
so low that's people income, who are doing pretty well financially, like securely
class,
at least.
Right, you know.
Yeah, 3%.
And,
even,
and that's not, you know, pretty well doesn't mean that you're free from economic insecurity.
Sure.
It just means that when you look at how much you're making, on paper at least, you're not low income. So you are middle income and above, right? Around 3% of your annual income goes to paying your energy bills. If you're a low-income household, it is three times that. It's almost 9% of your income goes to paying your energy bills. And in fact, what we actually see when you zero in even more, there are counties and communities in this country where that can get as high as 30%.
Wow.
30% of your income is going just to pay your utility bills. So this is a very real crisis that we really need to be talking about. And that's not, again, not limited to Black and brown communities.
Let's go on then to some of the work you're doing today with Clean Energy Works. And so Clean Energy Works promotes a model called inclusive utility investments. Unpackage that for me. How do you define an inclusive utility investment?
Well, let me start with the problem we're trying to solve, right? So for decades, we've had the technologies to make our buildings more energy efficient, that is less leaky, and to put in clean energy technologies. So whether it's heat pumps instead of your traditional gas, furnace, solar panels, those kinds of things. The question is, how are you going to pay for those things? And typically, there are only three ways in which those installations are made in your home that are paid for. One is that you qualify for some government program, typically low-income households. Second is that the utility might offer some rebate or incentive to offset the cost, and that is usually paid for by all of the customers that the utility company serves, right? Whether they realize it or not, they're pitching in a little bit of money. It goes into a pool, and that's what's used to pay for the rebates and incentives. But the primary way in which we expect people to pay for clean energy where they live is by personal debt. We expect you to make enough money that you can qualify for a loan, that you have good credit, that you are then willing to take out the loan and pay for that over time. And what we've seen is that most Americans are just not willing to do that. So we've spent decades of lots of pretty debt products that are offered that still are not moving the needle. What we champion is something
exclusive, right? You're saying it's also exclusive because not everybody like has the credit to take on those personal loans, for instance.
That's exactly right. And I should say there's a fourth way in which you could pay for this. You could just be rich and then you don't need government programs or debt. You could just write the check yourself, right? But that's just not where most Americans are. And so we have not seen any appreciable adoption of these technologies in the market space. So inclusive utility investments is a way for paying to get those energy efficiency upgrades and clean energy technologies brought into your home and installed where the consumer does not have to pay the upfront costs. So instead, we say, look, utility company, this is actually a capital investment that benefits your business model. And so the utility comes to where the building is. They audit the building to identify everything that makes sense for that specific location, everything that will save energy and save money. Both things have to happen. They put those installs in at the utility's expense, so you're not paying anything out of pocket. As a result of lowering your monthly bill, the utility is allowed to put a fee on that bill to recover the cost that they incurred in doing the work. But that fee has to be less than the savings that were estimated as a result of the work. So it's a win-win-win for the consumer. You're not paying anything out of pocket when the program is designed well. You're not paying anything up front. That's the biggest cost barrier that Americans face. It is not tied to your personal income or your credit score. It stays on the bill. So when you sell the home, the new owner is picking it up on the bill. Right. If you're a renter, the new tenant, it's picking it up on the bill. It's not following you around personally. And what we found is that when these programs are offered to consumers, you know, 90% or more people are just lining up to say, yes, this benefits me. I want it.
Yeah, because the biggest barrier, which is the upfront cost, is covered by the utility bill, and you're still coming out ahead because they're not allowed to charge you more than the savings that you're experiencing. So like, do you have an example of where this is working?
In North Carolina, Roanoke Cooperative in 2014. They set a goal of achieving whole home energy efficiency upgrades for 1,000 of their customers within 5 years, which is around 7% of their metered locations. So between 2015 to early 2022, they invested over $5 million to upgrade almost 700 homes.
Wow. And how do you get utilities to participate in this? Like, what are the key things that need to exist to sell them on the model?
Well, it depends on the kind of utility that you're talking about, right? So if we go back to the investor-owned utilities, the large for-profit utility companies, they are largely regulated in each state by state energy regulators. They might be called a public utilities commission, a public service commission, but these are bodies that have been empowered by legislators to oversee and regulate those private utility companies. And they can mandate that these utility companies have to offer these programs, whether on a pilot basis at first or just whole scale. So some of the motivation is coming from whether or not regulators are asking or mandating that these programs be put in place. The other thing that we try to show the utilities is that this is just good business sense. You know, if you think about the collectively wasted energy in a utility service area, just some leaky buildings, if you could capture that, that might be the equivalent of building a whole new brick and mortar power plant. This is low hanging fruit. So if you're a utility company, go with the cheapest, quickest, fastest, most effective way to manage the demand on your grid. And that would be through energy efficiency programs and through these demand response programs, right? So there are lots of different motivations that we try to tap into because there isn't any one single profile that adequately speaks to all of the different kinds of utility markets that are out there.
Right. And you know, I want to talk about regulations for a second, because I also realize that regulations governing these utilities also vary widely. But generally speaking, are policies already in place to encourage utilities to set up these incentive programs, these like pay-as-you-save programs? Or if not, what work needs to be done on the policy or the regulatory level?
And that's a large part of our work. You know, in the 10 years that Clean Energy Works has been in existence, we have really done a lot to bring this model to the attention of regulators. And there's still a lot of work to do to educate them about how these policies need to be formulated properly. But we have been successful in partnering with local community advocates in getting adoption in a couple dozen states and regions. And so that is a success, and we're very happy for that. Having the policies in place does not mean that we automatically see programs being implemented. So where I live, for example, in Georgia, the policy has been in place for quite some time. The investor-owned utility, the for-profit private utility company, offers up a program that is only targeted to very, very low-income households with very, very high energy bills. And one of the things, Kusha, that really attracted me to Clean Energy Works was the fact that this solution was income agnostic. It wasn't asking how much money you made or what class you fell into or were you on a government program. You know, it doesn't matter because, again, this makes sense from a utility business model that the utility should be driving this widely at scale, because it needs to be seen as part of the grid flexibility that needs to be put in place. And again, it because it's not linked to upfront cost payments, ideally, there's no pre-qualifying the consumer based on their credit, right? So overcoming the utility's historical practice of making programs like these an act of charity, something that only is offered to low-income folks, is something that has to be overcome as well.
Tamara Jones is co-executive director of Clean Energy Works. Tamara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again, Kusha.
All right, as we wrap up the show each week, we like to talk about one more thing that's on our minds. Kusha, why don't you go first?
Sure. So shout out to RMI for this cool website that I found that tracks all of the heat pump and water heater market stats in the United States, which is actually quite interesting to see. They have a lot of different graphs. The top line message that I got from this was that heat pumps have outsold gas furnaces consistently since 2021. And that equates to like 4.2 million heat pumps sold between April 2024 and March 2025. And 55% of water heaters sold in that same period, like over the past year, have been electric. So some interesting numbers there.
It's great. It's great to see those trends. I mean, I like to think that there's a lot of shifting happening, but it's nice to see the hard numbers. So cool. Well, my one more thing is related to today's episode because early voting is underway in the primary election for two seats on the Georgia Public Service Commission. And this is the statewide board that regulates utilities in the state of Georgia. Many states have these commissions. They're really important because these are the people who regulate the big utilities and decide if they can charge their customers more and where they're supposed to get their power from. And this is especially important this year for Georgians because they have not been able to vote on these seats for the last couple cycles because of a lawsuit. So this is where the power of the people comes in to vote for who regulates utilities in the state of Georgia.
Wow. It is where your vote can really make a difference. I love hearing stories like that.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can see what our team is reading by subscribing to our weekly newsletter. Sign up at climateone.org.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Greg Dalton, Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Ariana Brocious, Austin Colon, Megan Basilia, and Ben Testani. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Kusha Nevdar.
The opinions expressed during the preceding program do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WHFR, Henry Ford College, or its Board of Trustees. From the campus of Henry Ford College, you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.